Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 274 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her hormones. Yeah, see, I knew you would love this one. I can see all of you out there grab that pencil and pen. Oh, that's so old-fashioned. All right, whip out your iPads or something because you're going to want to hear this one. Before we begin this wonderful episode, just know that it's made possible by our friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode. We want you to rate and review the show because I'm sitting here waiting to hear that feedback. Love it, love it, love it when I hear from you. So that's your first reminder. I'll give you another one a little bit later on. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about Her.
So I'm sitting here looking at my big computer screen, and I have up right in front of me the beautiful website of Dr. Heather Hirsch. It says Health by Heather Hirsch, MD, and it's this ocean, and all the little waves just keep coming up to the shore, and I'm almost asleep. I'm just so relaxed and calm and ridiculous. And below it says Menopause Support and Midlife Help. Oh my gosh, I cannot imagine a better place to be able to find wit and wisdom about all things women in midlife. So what are we talking about today? We're talking about women, hormones, and especially today with stress right through the ceiling, COVID, everything hitting us. What's that doing to our hormones? So Dr. Heather Hirsch is a board-certified physician in internal medicine and completed advanced fellowship training in women's health at the Cleveland Clinic, one of my favorite places, also with a good colleague of mine out there. Her specialty practice includes internal medicine and office gynecology with a focus on menopausal hormone therapy, contraception, and family planning. That also includes breast health, sexual dysfunction, and urinary incontinence, too. Yeah, the whole spectrum. Her fellowship training included an emphasis on scholarly activity, development of women's health curriculum, and clinical research and leadership. Dr. Hirsch, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm just sitting here staring at your website going, this is just a pretty amazing place, and I think everyone needs to know to run over to Heather Hirsch, and that's HIRSCHMD.com, because guess what you're going to get? You're going to get a hormone health guide, and this is a personalized one that is absolutely free. All you have to do is just download it. I think that that's totally cool. Now, one of the things I first was drawn to when I came to your website, it said mission statement. My mission is to expose the current gaps in knowledge in midlife women's health and to help women find the menopause support and care they deserve. What? Wait a minute. Current gaps? Surely you jest, right? Okay, Dr. Hirsch, why did you get involved in this in the first place?
Well, I really have found my passion is taking care of women, particularly at midlife and menopause. And I can almost recite that mission statement by memory at this point because I say it to my patients, honestly, several times a day. So in your lovely introduction, you mentioned I did my fellowship at Cleveland Clinic. And after my internal medicine residency, going into my fellowship training, I was really interested in contraception and reproductive health. But I realized, I came out, that the end of our reproductive cycles, the end of our reproductive health is most certainly the area where we're leaving women behind. We're not doing enough to educate, you know, really physicians, starting with our medical education and our residency education and training. And certainly there's so many myths and misconceptions. And then that leaves women, you know, the people that I see every single day, so confused about what is the right thing to do. There's still a lot of stigma and shame and taboo around the end of a reproductive cycle. So I'm absolutely obsessed with taking care of people in this time. My patients are so diverse. They're so unique. They're so busy. And so it's such a special time to take care of patients.
You know, when you think about this, you said something that really struck home, and that is this whole issue of taboo. What is the taboo thing?
You know, I'm still not sure. I think that this may have to do with the, you know, the fact that women's health is socially charged. You could even go so far as to say politically charged, but let's not get that far right now. But it's socially charged, and this means that it affects the way women's health at midlife is seen in the media, in the news, in the doctor's office, with their employers or at work, and even at home, in terms of how they deal with their family members. And so over time, you know, I hear so many of my patients say, gee, I literally, Pam, had a patient yesterday with six sisters say, none of my sisters and I have ever talked about our menopausal symptoms. It's still taboo.
Oh, boy.
Still taboo, even within the family.
Just amazing, isn't it? Doesn't it sort of blow your mind? I think it's also, you know, it may be a bit of a generational thing, too, just trying to understand, because it's a piece of the aging process, which, you know, nobody seems to want to talk about either. You know, just very recently, I interviewed for my podcast, Dr. Marcia Stefanik, probably one of the pioneers in the study of women's health. She's heads up the prevention center at Stanford University and was integral and continues to be in the Women's Health Initiative at the National Institutes of Health. And as you know, she really gets into, you know, right down into the weeds with what is it about women and the aging process that really, quite frankly, differentiates themselves from men? And, you know, we talk about men and aging and it's like, ho-hum. But when we talk about women and aging, it's like, rot-row, because now we're talking about things like changes in appearance and stereotypic visuals that are not exactly pleasant. And then there's that whole thing about menopause and being, I don't know, like a has-been or something. Does any of that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we certainly, our society has in some ways really set up unrealistic expectations around aging. And again, really more hyper-focused on women. And, you know, something I see is not only the focus on aging and beauty and youth, but also so many of my patients and I discuss sexual health and sexual health changes at menopause and midlife, maybe when their kids are finally gone. And I think also while there's never one right or wrong answer, certainly there's also unrealistic expectations about what healthy sexual life is and sexual function. So this spans, you know, so much. And really, I think, really obviously, really what we're looking at is that men have studied sex hormones their whole lives, and women's hormones go up and down every month, and then they go wonky in perimenopause, and then they crash and burn after menopause. And so really an unfair playing field here, right?
Oh my gosh. And, you know, and then we're sitting here. All right. Now here's a real core of what we're going to talk about. And that is, look at the level of stress we have today. We're living with the COVID era. We have financial, you know, and economic stress, political strife. I'm not even going to start on that one. Oh my gosh. And, you know, there's caregiving going on. There's medical illnesses going on. And what is this doing to women? I'm just curious, as we're sitting back and trying to understand how women manifest resilience. What do you think?
You know, it's so interesting. And I think when I think about what's going on in the world today with the pandemic and especially women in general, I kind of think of this as, you know, three phases, if you will. There's kind of the acute phase, which I think we're still kind of in, where we're all trying to rapidly assimilate to new things like wearing masks, not seeing relatives or loved ones, not traveling anymore, you know, maybe losing jobs or et cetera. And then there's sort of what's going to be phase two, is when we kind of get into so many things that may have been missed, you know, in the acute phase. And maybe we're in a little bit of phase two right now, where, you know, at first medical appointments and, you know, chronic illnesses and medication refills went by the wayside because women tend to put everyone else before them. Then we're going to kind of get into this phase two, where we have everyone kind of backfiling in and trying to then sort of quickly resolve the things that may be during the acute phase that have been neglected. And then I think there's sort of a longer phase, like a PTSD or a trauma phase from all of these things that we're going through.
You know, when I'm thinking about this too, most of the work I did at the NIH was in stress physiology. And one of the things we did learn was that stress hormone, which is cortisol, likes to traverse with estrogen. And so when you said a woman's hormones are going wonky, especially during the perimenopause, one can only imagine then that where estrogen goes, well, cortisol is paralleling. And so this is part of what goes on with the hot flashes, with thermoregulation issues, with her ability to be able to maintain some level of, regularity with her hormones. So if stress is really rocking and rolling here in a big way, which it is for most people these days, then I wonder, just sort of like wondering out loud, what's going on with a woman, say, for instance, when she's in the midst of her hormonal storms like hot flashes? What happens to that under stress?
I think that is an excellent question. And to further expand that, I actually started to just poll my audiences across my various social media platforms and simply just throw the question out there. I said, hey, are your hot flashes getting worse because of all of this stress with everything going on? And I really expected them to say yes. And of course, this is just a random sampling, but I really got a 50-50 split, which is really fascinating. I don't yet know what that means. Some of my patients said, yes, they're worse. Some of my patients said, no, they're the same. And actually, about a 10% said they're better. So I don't know why that they're better. I have no good explanation for that. But if we think it's almost like a 50-50 split, and this is, you know, this is quite interesting, because maybe it means that there is other factors at play. Maybe it means you're so stressed you can't even register your hot flashes and other things are high on the list. Or for some reason, like the hypothesis would lead to, more stress means more cortisol released from those adrenal glands, you know, maybe worsening those hot flashes, or there's trouble sleeping. I asked about both things, you know, anxiety, I asked about mood and hot flashes, and I got a 50-50 split in terms of if they were better or worse.
Okay, I'm going to throw it out there. Listening to you, I was fascinated. 50-50. Okay, so,
yeah.
You know, what I have found is that many people with all of this stress going on, many women, are actually looking at this as an opportunity to get their stuff together. All right. So, for instance, have you noticed, I know you're currently practicing at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston with Harvard, and I bet I'll put money on it that up in Boston, more people are outdoors, which quite frankly is the safest place to be these days. Just so long as it's not part of protests and things like that, where you're sitting on top of each other. But when you're just outside, because Boston's one of my favorite cities, and there's so many places to walk, the parks, this and that, that more and more people have just sort of, you know, heard the call to arms and legs and just get out there and be more physically active so that you're healthier. And by being healthier, you're able to hopefully prevent, if not reduce, any consequences of COVID. I'll put money on it that more people like your wonderful cohort in your social media community are actually meditating more, that they may be eating better, they may be doing more physical activity, because I've been astounded. I'm on the board of trustees of the American College of Sports Medicine, and, you know, for years, as you're well aware, we've been ranting and raving, oh, please, would someone just get physically active out there? Just saying. I mean, just walk, for crying out loud. And then next thing we know, all throughout the United States, people are outdoors walking more for all the host of reasons I just mentioned. And I'm wondering, I'll put a little bit of money on this, that is also affecting a woman's hormones and her incidence of hot flashes. What do you think?
Oh, certainly. I think you nailed it right on the head there, because people are not driving anymore. So people are mostly at home. They are working from home, which is leading to some more flexible work hours. For example, even me, when I'm not seeing patients, today is my academic day. I'm actually sitting in my bedroom, and, you know, I had, for lunchtime, I went out and exercised in the garage and came back inside. Those are things that I just wouldn't be able to do when I'm normally kind of expected to be in my academic office on a Friday. But then I make up for that little work, maybe after my kids go to bed and women are outside walking and they're meditating. And I think when all of this started in March, there was like an influx of messages on really how to adapt. And I think women are resilient, like you asked, and they really have adapted, you know, some of them in a way that's actually making them so much healthier. They've got the time to meditate. They're not rushing off to work. And when women are thinking about, you know, their children who are at college and or their children's relationships, so often that's what keeps women awake. You know, their children are in a sense kind of stalled in one spot, and maybe there are less stressors in some ways for some women.
That's very interesting. And then when you think about purpose and meaning in your life, that's what gets you up in the morning. It's interesting that not all women at this very moment, they could be living alone or whatever, but caregiving is front and center. And it tends to give so many women hardcore purpose and meaning in their life, whether they're caregiving children, you know, family members at any age, et cetera, et cetera. Friends, even. I mean, it doesn't matter. Doesn't have to be family members. But what I'm thinking about is I think that is a real driving force in resilience. When you think about resilience, you think about the ability to be able to adapt and adjust to changes, whether it's environmental, social, you know, whatever's going on right now. We now have a new normal. And because we have to be able to caregive. And unfortunately, women tend to caregive sometimes to the point of forgetting themselves. So we always have to draw them in. But that caregiving thing necessitates adapting and adjusting much faster to new normals so you can continue and progress. What do you think about the whole issue of caregiving for women in their prime?
I certainly think that for some women, it is so much a part of their identity. And even though there's certain gripes and we should still work on those parts of ourselves that are just us, you know, there's so much joy and there's so much love and caregiving. And certainly it's such a traditional, you know, role that women have. Of course, there's some women who, you know, choose not to or don't have children, but certainly they're still caregiving, oftentimes for pets or plants or their house. And so we get so much meaning from caring for someone. And then, of course, there's always that tipping point where it's consuming too much of them, and then it's starting to stress them out and sort of to spiral. So I think for women, it's really important that when we're caregiving, we also make sure we find that balance. And there's so much about self-care, but it doesn't need to be just manicures. You know, it could be buying yourself flowers. It could be taking your walk in the morning. It could be, you know, any one of the things that you like. I went out kayaking on the Charles River for the first time last week, and it was just so lovely to be able to do something for me. But now that everyone's back home and kids are home from college, certainly some women have had a little bit of a break and then kind of get to have their kids back again. And I think that's probably bringing a lot of joy to some people, you know, and it's, I think, always hard for people to say that they're okay during this time, or they actually feel good, or maybe they even feel better because we're so acutely aware of our neighbors and other situations. But certainly, I think what we've just hammered out in the last 20 minutes or so, that some people are really getting some benefits from this new way of life.
Wow. And basically, you know, transforming lemons into lemonade. You know, Einstein said, in the midst of difficulty lies opportunity. And I think some women are finding that opportunity. It might be those 50% who kind of weighed in and said, hey, you know, I'm actually doing a bit better. Maybe, like you said, to your point, they now have time to take a breath and to regroup and to reassess where they are with their life right now, and maybe see some opportunities here to improve their self-care, which I think would be great. Now, you have an online course on evidence-based education on menopause. I'm curious. So there's been so much confusion about hormones, no hormones. What do you do for a woman as she, you know, enters the perimenopause and is starting to have some issues? How do you, as a contemporary provider of these types of services to women in their prime, how do you approach this now? Because, you know, in the old days, it was basically they got a blow off, or, you know, they popped a pill or whatever. They were sort of blown off and generically thrown into one big collective of, here, take this and don't bother me. How do you now approach this?
You know, I think so much of that dismissive nature, because it still goes on every single day. And being that I do consultative menopause and hormone therapy discussions at the Brigham, I typically see patients who've seen one, two, maybe three other doctors and really been dismissed along the way. So, you know, one of the big keys, I think, is the individualization and the shared decision-making process. And those are certainly key words, but I'm not throwing them out there lightly just to throw them out there. I always teach my students and my residents and any trainee who's with me and sitting and listening to me do a discussion with a patient, that there is never one right or wrong answer. And it really depends on a culmination of that patient's past history, their current symptoms, their top health goals and priorities, and what risks they will or will not assume. And so a big part of my role, besides for educating physicians, is actually to educate my women, because certainly I think you've hit on something so important, that even if the physicians do understand this information and maybe they, you know, are used to prescribing hormone therapy, or they kind of have the same thing where it's an individualized basis, the patient, the woman, is still very confused. And so when I see a new patient, I typically spend a good half an hour just discussing why we've gotten to where we've gotten today and how the data has really kind of waxed and waned and why that is in a logical way. And so, you know, if I could summarize it in one sentence, we really now know that if you're within 10 years of menopause and you have no known contraindications to estrogen, estrogen really has oftentimes much more benefits, and those benefits greatly outweigh the risks for someone who is suffering. But it's certainly much more complicated than that. It's not always just yes, I'm for hormone therapy, or no, I'm not for hormone therapy. It should be, what does the patient need? What's best for the patient? What's going to get her to where she wants to go? So I made that course. It's actually a very long course. It's very detailed, and I made it so that people who couldn't see me in the office, I can only see X amount of people a day, could be able to watch that, feel as if they're having that conversation with me.
And I think that the thing that's really driving this, and an element that's really important for women, is individualize. Don't give me something that worked for, the woman down the street. I want you to honor me and my incredibly unique journey with perimenopause, because I think that what's happened in the past, you said the word dismissive, you're absolutely correct. But even worse still, it was just throwing everybody together like we're just one big, mob of the same thing. And I'm sorry, but each woman is unique, has her own things going on. By the time you've hit around the age of 45, 50, lots is going on, both in terms of stress, in terms of the ability to be able to, take a lot of maybe medical conditions you may have and put them, into an integrative, holistic way of looking at who you are. And then where do hormones fit into all of this? I also think the other piece is, and correct me if I'm wrong, tell me how you do this. A woman is a dynamic living, breathing entity. So what you do one year may be different than what you do the next year. How do you take that into consideration?
Absolutely. So much can change in a year. For example, I had a patient who was on hormone therapy and doing really well, whose older sister developed breast cancer. And so it's important to ask about new onset of family history, and also to factor that in if she wanted to continue that year or stop. And I think for many women, when you see a family member fall ill, there's a lot of either guilt or there's worry. And so a lot of what I do is reassess, rediscuss safety and risks and benefits and keep individualizing it, but really understand what's been going on with her during the year. So my students are always so amazed how much social history and background and things that I want to know about my patients, because I think that plays so much of a factor into her decision-making about her medications and her overall health. So right down to what she does for work and where her family lives and how close she may be to them and how many pets are in the house, maybe jumping in her bed, keeping her up at night. You got to know all those things for when you reassess every year.
Excellent, excellent. And that's why, how often do women check in with you? What's your normal thing? Let's just say, a woman comes in and she's about, the average age of menopause in the United States is about 52-ish. So let's just say she comes in 52, and let's say she's, what if she had some, she's having some hot flashes, maybe some brain fog, her energy level is pretty low. And then you go ahead and you meet with her, you individualize. When do you check in with her again? How do you do that?
So I learned this trick from Dr. Holly Thacker. She is the menopause guru at the Cleveland Clinic and my mentor. And I've kind of adapted to what works for me after watching her. But when I start my patient on a particular regimen, be it hormone therapy or not, I actually usually see my patients again in somewhere between 8 to 12 weeks, and I do a check-in, and I want to know, did these things move the needle in the direction that you wanted it to go? And realistic expectations are also a big part of it. So while some women have they'll have fears of hormone therapy use. I think some women have too much expectations that it's going to turn us into like our 20-year-old self. And I wish that were the case. If I could bottle that, I would certainly make a lot more money. But again, realistic expectations about aging are really important. So I check in with my patients after about 8 to 12 weeks. So that's 2 to 3 months, just depending. And we keep doing that until they say, okay, I feel really good at where I'm at. And then I say, okay, I'll see you again next year. Now, because I do consultative practice, sometimes then I have my patients, if they've seen me for a while and they're very stable, see if their internist or their gynecologist can continue them on their regimen. And some patients are able to do that. And that's actually sort of where I start to branch into educating other physicians as well. So that's sort of my inner workings of how I work with my patients in midlife and at menopause.
I just think it's really important for all of my listeners and the Herb podcast to understand that you need individualized, customized approaches to how you're going to be able to navigate these changing times throughout the perimenopause. Don't think that it's static, like boom, there you are, suddenly you've sort of arrived. Well, not really. Every day it's something new, every week, every month. And to be able to understand that people like Dr. Heather Hirsch exist, people who will actually listen to you. And I'm going to tell you something, as a fellow physician, if your current practitioner is not listening and is not individualizing, find someone else. That's so terribly important. You've got to be able to find someone who's going to listen. Now, for the last piece of this, Heather, how important is lifestyle in navigating the perimenopause?
Well, I think we just did this mini experiment, whereas we talked about how women are walking, meditating, taking time for themselves, connecting with their close family members. And, you know, we've really shown how even just doing that can certainly make a big difference. And so while I certainly think there are times when women need medications, just like childbirth or just like death, you know, those things are natural, normal, just as menopause are, but doesn't mean we don't help you if you need intervention. But certainly, whether you take treatment or not, you know, nothing is a big band-aid. You've got to do that work yourself. And so those lifestyle factors are really, really, really important. The biggest one probably being sleep hygiene and learning how to get yourself to fall asleep and stay asleep and, you know, keeping your TV out of your bedroom, and sleep hygiene is so important. Exercise and just making that a part of your daily routine. Diet choices, just trying to limit, you know, the processed foods or the fast food. Certainly every once in a while, everyone deserves a treat. And then just our mental health, just things to kind of keep us calm and in the moment and present. I think those big areas are the four areas where we certainly, no matter if we take treatment or not, they should never sort of be abandoned.
I love it. This is absolutely fabulous. Everyone, we have been listening to Dr. Heather Hirsch. Her wonderful work is on prominent display on her website, which is just so soothing. The whole time you've been talking, but having this, the ocean thing on your website, on the homepage, just sort of playing with me here. Oh my gosh, it's so soothing. Just run on over to Heather Hirsch, and that's HIRSCHMD.com, to learn more, not only about her work, but also to learn more about menopause. Get some education here. Ramp up that knowledge about how you can optimize your ability to navigate through these, well, sometimes treacherous waters, when we're really trying to, you know, hold on to that sense of well-being during a time of life that is so pivotal. You know, Heather, thank you. I really, really appreciate your being on the Herb podcast.
Oh, well, I'm so delighted to be able to have the opportunity to talk to your listeners and provide a I guess, a listening ear, if you will.
Absolutely. Again, run on over to Dr. Heather Hirsch's website to learn more. And oh gosh, I hope everyone out there has a Dr. Heather Hirsch available to help them. That would be my hope. So listen, everyone, this has just been an incredibly informative and fun and wonderful and very, very, informative session with Dr. Heather Hirsch. I mean, this episode, I hope, has helped you understand and empower you to know that there is help out there. Just find it. Get someone who's going to listen to you. All right, now take a moment, run on over to iTunes. Every one of you out there in Herb Podcast land, rate and review the show. You know, I'm just sitting here waiting to hear from you because your feedback is everything to me. I want to know your thoughts. Why? Well, because I'm Dr. Pam Peake. I'm host of the Herb Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peake or Twitter at Pam Peake MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and stay safe and stay well.